This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as we approach the July 4th Independence Day holiday, we're going to squeeze in one more Q&A with Layla. So for your listening pleasure over the weekend, as you're relaxing, maybe you've got a little extra time, some leisure time, listen in, because this is your opportunity to hear answers to diverse questions that listeners send in. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions, and you never know what you're going to hear about. So it's usually a lively 40 minutes or so as I join Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin answering questions. How are you doing today, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. Looking forward to the holiday weekend. How about you?
Indeed. Yeah, it's going to be good. And, you know, I've got I got a couple of things waiting for me at my you know, I usually go out to my weekend home on Long Island, and I've got I need my bicycle. I messed up the gears on my bicycle.
Oh.
First ride of the season, and I just totally destroyed the derailleurs on my bicycle somehow. It's amazing how much damage you can inflict in about 1 second.
Oh, my goodness.
I wasn't hurt, but I...
Is it in the bicycle hospital?
It's in the bicycle hospital, but I'm very happy to say that this weekend I'm going to have my bicycle back. It's going to be, you know, all fixed up, and you know, it's an opportunity to upgrade. I'm going to get an even better set of derailleurs for the, you know, like deluxe Campagnola derailleurs, which will make me hopefully zoom faster, smoother, and
more power.
More
power.
Yeah, so you know. It's a little bit of an indulgence, but hey, you know, it's not the little red Porsche.
Which doesn't give you any exercise at all.
Which doesn't give you any exercise at all, and it's a little bit of an indulgence, but it's an exercise. I think it served me well. You know, I posted this on Facebook. I came across an interesting website, which was talked about in a little article in the New York Times about the benefits of exercise for older individuals. And, you know, as I cross the big divide from my 50s into my 60s, I guess, you know, I'm starting to qualify for that cadre. Although, you know, I feel about, you know, depends on the day. So it ranges from 11 to 35, you know, just pick a day.
There you go.
It varies.
11 is interesting.
11 can be interesting, you know, a precocious 11-year-old you know, at best on some days. But so what this, there's a little calculator, and I'm trying to dial it up here on my iPad as we talk, that is a very interesting calculator because it is a test at www.worldfitnesslevel.org. And so you enter your chronological age and you enter statistics and then you enter information about your exercise habits and your heart rate, and your height and your weight and, you know, your fitness level. And then it renders you your fitness age.
And, did 11 come up?
No, because 11 year, I was like a pudgy kind of, you know, studious 11-year-old, a little bit of a nerd. But so I was happy to see that, you know, chronologically I'm 62 years old, but it says, so the truth of the matter is you are 62 years of old. However, you have the fitness of an average 27-year-old. I thought that was pretty
fabulous.
Cool. Pretty cool. So that made my day.
That's great.
And so listeners can go to this website, www.worldfitnesslevel.org. And you can do this for yourself. And, you know, I think it's something that can either acknowledge your excellent fitness status, or maybe give you kind of a heads up that your fitness status is not up to snuff. I mean, we would hope that your fitness status indicates that your fitness level is that of an individual younger than you are chronologically. But, you know, if you're 38 and you have the fitness level of a, you know,
37-year-old.
Yeah, that, you know, or 50-year-old, which is the case. I think really the case for a lot of people, unfortunately.
That's true. And so, people who don't move around at all, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Interestingly, they actually, one of the questions, there was a lot of detailed questions in there, and one of the questions is, how much do you sit every day? And I had to be truthful that I sit a minimum of 8 hours per day because, you know, it's hard to stand up and talk to patients. I don't know. It makes them nervous.
It doesn't work well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I could say, hey, let's take a walk in the park and I'll talk to you, you know, but so a lot of our work is sitting. And they actually say, and I think that detracted from my score somewhat. I don't know how they figure it, but, you know, I do a lot of sitting. And they say, you know, the new meme is sitting is the new smoking.
Right, right.
And there's just something deleterious about sitting. Even if you exercise, you can't quite compensate for the fact that you sit. And also, I think sitting is not great orthopedically. It leads to more back problems and injuries. So
We're meant to be more reclined.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I think that's better for the back.
Maybe
but
I can,
you know,
can I get a recumbent
say,
a recumbent seat for my office? You know, like a recumbent bicycle, and you know,
oh,
like,
there you go. Or stand, you know, walk on a treadmill while you're talking to patients.
Maybe I could lie down and I could put like a mirror in the ceiling. The mirror would like reflect the image of the patient, and then I could just like, you know, lie on my back and, you know, opine. Because I do a lot of sitting in the office talking to patients, and you do too.
Well, the rule is I do too. Yes, but the rule
but
is
but you're always jumping up. You're jittery too. You walk around. You're always walking around. I see you in the hall, like going back and forth.
We're supposed to get up at least once an hour and walk around.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
And they're actually fitness devices. You know, some of the new devices prompt you to do that. It gives you like a little like the iWatch and some of these Fitbit things. They give you a little zets, like a little vibration that says, you know, you've been sitting too long. Get up. You know, move around. You know,
get up, move around. Exactly.
Get the blood circulating. Prevent those red blood cells from sticking together. You know, change positions, and that's good. All right. So anyway, so
it's worldfitnesslevel.org.
worldfitnesslevel.org, and
okay.
you can take the test. And so I challenge you to take the test, and you know, because I'm a competitive individual, I want to see what your level is.
Okay.
I mean, even though I know you are 27, so you know.
No.
Wait, you're not supposed to hear you know. Women aren't supposed to, you know.
But I'm not that woman.
Speaking of female stereotypes, I was so excited to see, you know, I'm not a big soccer fan, frankly. I don't get it. And, you know, it can be really boring because they're going back and forth, they're back and forth, you know, and nothing happens.
That's the real football, you know.
Right, I know.
In the rest of the world,
People in other countries, they just love it. They appreciate the nuances, the ball handling and the passing and all that stuff. It's fine. Okay, great. But I have to say, I really enjoyed watching the American women defeat the Germans in a soccer game that was actually broadcast on a major network. It was broadcast live on Fox, which I thought was very good because they were great. And I really hope that a lot of young gals, and I really think there are probably millions of young gals watching with their parents. And I think it was very inspiring to see these very competitive, fit and sportsmanlike women compete.
That's wonderful.
And they were very aggressive, but they were very sportsmanlike. There was a real body contact, but there wasn't it absolutely defeated any female stereotype, negative stereotype that you might have seen. They weren't like, you know,
love it.
They weren't like, you know, biting, kicking, you know, pulling each other's hair or anything like that. They were just competing on an even playing field.
Uh-huh.
And they really dominated the Germans. And the Germans are a powerhouse in soccer. And that's their national sport. And so we are really coming along as a world power in soccer. And I really think that is the result of some excellent programs. You know, a lot of young kids, not Little League anymore. It's not Pop Warner football. It's soccer. And
well, you know, there's another reason for that, Dr. Hoffman, I think.
Yep.
They don't have to buy so much equipment. It's just the ball.
It's very democratic. Yeah.
You know, it's not like
ball
with football,
and a field.
You need all kinds of padding
right.
and the helmet. And I think that kind of has something to do with
And you can play
it.
In inclement weather, you know, whether it's hot, whether it's cold. You know, basically it just doesn't have to be, you know, a hailstorm or a tornado. And, you know, you can get out there and do it. And I think that's great. So my congratulations to the women's team. I thought that was wonderful. And, you know, by the time some of you listen to the podcast, we'll know the outcome of the finals because they'll be playing Japan or England. I guess the elimination, the semifinal for that elimination is going to be today or tomorrow. I'm not sure which.
You go, girls.
Yeah, great. It was great. It was great. And you know, I got to say this, is that, you know, speaking of stereotypes, in some ways the men are more, exhibit more, shall we say, these female or, you know, negative connotation female characteristics with their histrionics, you know, their dramatic flopping, their argumentative, you know, style.
They're
being divas. The men were more divas than the women, you know. And I think, yeah, exactly, exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in soccer games that I've seen, I mean, so that was great.
Yeah.
All right. Let us proceed to questions.
We have a question from Elena. Dr. Hoffman, on your recent Intelligent Medicine show, you were discussing air quality and cardiovascular health. I'm curious to know, which do you prefer, ionic air purifiers or HEPA filters? Should we be using the HEPA-style purifier to reap the health benefits that you describe? Thank you in advance. Elena.
Okay. So I'm going to weigh in on the side of the HEPA filters. They're actually much better at eliminating particulate matter from the air. And they're based on, you know, old-fashioned filtration through sometimes carbon or mesh filters. And they, you know, and the way that you know is when you clean the filter, it's just full of dirt. It's full of junk. It's full of, it turned, the filters turn black and they have to be cleaned frequently. Here's the problem with ionic. Ionic, what it does is it puts a negative charge on the particles. Now, there is some literature that suggests that negative ions are good for mood, and you obtain negative ions sometimes at the seashore because the crashing of the waves generates in the air negative ions. So that may be why the seashore is very relaxing and inspiring and health-promoting for some people, because negative ions have a good effect. However, what negative ions do is they put a charge on particles, and that does take them out of the air because a charged particle tends to stick. And it will stick to surfaces, so it will mess it. You'll have to paint your apartment much more frequently, especially around the ionizer. You'll sometimes, and I've learned this to bitter experience, you'll develop like a carbon halo around your ionizer, and then you'll have to paint the wall again. But the concern is that the ionized particles may also gravitate towards your lungs, and before they're taken out of circulation, and they, you know, attach to the filter in the ionizer, because ionizers do have filters, the charged particles may enter your lungs and stick to your lung surfaces. So I am no longer a proponent of that. Yeah. You know, I have to say that I think that it was sort of a craze for a while, and it does eliminate particulates from the air, but not in a good way, in my opinion. I mean, look, somebody who's really a professional in this field, they may have more insight on this, and they may come up with a reasonable defense of air ionizers. But I have to say, I'm not...
the makers of air ionizers, I'm
sure. There you go. I mean, we got to just always look for a full disclosure of their vested interest. But I mean, I have no dogs in the fight on this. I'm not, they're not a sponsor. You know, we welcome a sponsor. If, you know, somebody wants to sponsor a really good HEPA filter, that'd be a great addition to our armamentarium of great sponsors here on Intelligent Medicine.
Okay. Elena, we hope that answers your question. Okay. Let's see here. We've got a question from Gail. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I need to lose weight. Gail is 5'4 and 158 pounds and 62 years of age. She thinks she has metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance. She's been having an egg every day for breakfast for the past month, along with what she calls a healthy carb and a fat. Gail is feeling enormous fatigue after breakfast, and her energy gets better later in the day. You think I'm allergic to eggs? Do you think if I am, it's hindering my weight loss efforts?
Okay.
Well,
what do you think? I mean,
well,
this is like a day in the office at the Hoffman Center. We get asked questions like this all the time.
Right. I question the healthy carb first scale. I question what that is, and if you are feeling fatigue after breakfast, I would first blame the carb. Yes, food allergies can cause fatigue. If you are indeed allergic to eggs, that could be causing your fatigue.
That likely with eggs. I mean, mostly, don't you see the manifestation of egg sensitivity as other things, often gastrointestinal allergy, you know?
That's true, too.
But, I mean, I guess it's a possibility. It's always a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. And it's an uncommon symptom of food allergy, fatigue, but it is there.
The other thing that occurs to me, and you see this all the time, is, you know, you change people's diets. And this person actually, although she's still having carbs, she's going to a lower carb diet, it sounds like.
Yes.
And she may still be going through the preliminary stages of carbohydrate withdrawal, which leaves
possible.
A lot of people flat. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, I think humans are sort of like hybrid vehicles. You know, they can work on gasoline or they can work on electricity.
Mm-hmm.
But the switch off with humans is not as efficient and rapid as it is in a car, you know, that, you know, goes from electricity to gas or gas to electricity. Because when you are weaned off of carbohydrates, sometimes it takes you a while to establish an efficient energy production from fats. I mean, if you have fats, you know, a ketogenic diet, you'll actually derive energy from the dietary fats, but also burning down your own fats.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a while sometimes for people to establish that. And people go through kind of a profound withdrawal. They feel let down. They feel achy, tired, depressed. And maybe that's part of what's going on here.
Maybe that's a possibility.
Yeah.
That's a possibility for Gail, sure. Something that could help that along, maybe, I think, would be L-carnitine.
Okay.
Because that could be something.
L-carnitine helps to shuttle fat into the cell.
Into the mitochondria.
Right.
To help it burn off and to just enhance that fat-burning metabolism, which is important. So, Gail, I would first see about getting rid of that healthy carb and see how you feel, but add some L-carnitine and maybe in about 10 days or so, you should start to feel better and not so much fatigue. But even ultimately, if that's not helping her fatigue, she could give up the eggs. You know, we could all on our own do a trial of food elimination at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not hard to do. Anybody who suspects a food should take it off the list for, say, 2 weeks and see if they feel any better. And then what happens when they reintroduce that food if their symptoms return?
Right. That's called unmasking of food intolerance is that you get off and then you re-challenge. And then you may notice that, like, wow, you know, I didn't realize it, but, you know, all these symptoms were attributable to that food. I was having this food day in and day out, and I was having the symptoms all the time. And then when you clear out your system and you reintroduce the food, you can actually make the connection.
Right. And just to give a clue to everybody, including Gail, is that typically, the most frequent foods that you eat or the foods we eat on a daily basis are the primary suspects.
Yeah.
So that's worth some thought and consideration as well. Keeping a food diary is very helpful in pointing those out and saying, maybe it's my coffee, maybe it's the caffeine in my coffee, maybe it's the glass of wine that you drink every evening, maybe it's the toast or the cereal you're having every morning, maybe it's the milk you're drinking or the cheese you're eating. These are the primary suspects. Wheat and dairy are always in there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Best of luck, Gail. She signs Eggless in Ossining. Okay. Next question.
Yep.
Dr. Hoffman?
Yep.
Oh, okay. We've got from Cheryl. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I just got through listening to your Memorial Day broadcast. You talked about protosaur magnesium. My husband was just diagnosed with bipolar 1 and is now on Depakote. We've always taken lots of supplements, including magnesium, but I'm wondering if the protosaur product would be better for him and might help him with his moods and depression. Also, anything else you can recommend for people with bipolar as far as supplements would be appreciated. Love your show, and thank you very much.
Okay, we talk about protosorb magnesium as a new form of magnesium that is more targeted to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And so magnesium, of course, is important in every part of the body. If you have muscle cramps, you know, it's important to get adequate magnesium into your bloodstream, to your muscles. But there are actually mental and mood disorders that are associated with low magnesium, fatigue, depression, anxiety, certainly, because in anxiety, you develop a lot of catecholamines, stress hormones, and stress hormones cause magnesium to leak from the body. So many patients with panic attacks and anxiety are in a vicious cycle of magnesium deficiency, and they sort of, you know, it's the panic and anxiety exacerbated, and then the lack of magnesium may accentuate the panic and anxiety. So we want the magnesium to get to the brain. This Protozorb is a new magnesium delivery system that is recent, and the studies on it, I have to admit, you know, are a little limited, but the studies are encouraging, suggesting that this is a vehicle or a carrier molecule for getting magnesium to the brain where it does its work. So it's magnesium 3-8, and it's a little bit of an unusual form of magnesium. It's bioavailable to the brain. I actually had a very nice conversation with a patient the other day where he said he really thinks that it made a difference when he switched from, you know, what we usually recommend is jigsaw magnesium, which is very fine, very absorbed. Oh, I'm sorry, he was taking magnesium taurate for his heart.
Oh, okay.
And I suggested, you know, he's feeling tired, he had some mood issues, and he says he really got a lift from taking the Protozorb magnesium, which is available at drhoffman.com. I think it's made by a company called Protocol, which just manufactures for doctors, not to the general public. So Protozorb, it's called P-R-O-T-O-Sorb, S-O-R-B. And some of our astute listeners are picking up on it and enjoying the benefits. So clearly, there's an anxiety component to manic depression. Manic depression is associated with instability of neuronal transport. It's almost thought to be seizure-like. And therefore, this person is taking an anti-seizure medication, Depakote. Depakote has a calming effect on the nerves, and it tends to eliminate the profound highs and lows of manic depression or bipolar disorder. Used to, I mean, it's no longer called manic depression.
Manic depression,
except in the Jimi Hendrix song. Greatest song ever. Depression touching my soul. I know what I want, but I just don't know. Music, sweet. Oh, no. Stop me. Stop me, Layla. I know that you're, did you ever play that song in your band?
No. Okay. We mostly did original stuff, not anything else.
Okay. You didn't do a cover for Jimi Hendrix?
No.
Okay.
If we did, it would be only obscure ones.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You're like avant-garde.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. Someday, you know, we'll play some outtakes from your...
okay.
Yeah, okay. So,
what are the supplements for bipolar? Fish oil comes to mind.
Absolutely. Fish oil, again, because fish oil stabilizes the membranes. And fish oil is also helpful for seizure disorders, epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we actually want a high DHA omega-3 for manic depression.
Yeah.
And high dose, we'll, you know, have patients take like 9 a day. That would be very beneficial. Mm-hmm. And studies show that that actually helps. There's a doctor, and I forget his name, at Harvard, who is the developer. You can get some of this information at omegabright.com. He's, you know, I can look this up during our next break, and I'll give you the information. Who's a big proponent of omega-3s for bipolar disorder and other mental conditions. It's very clear that it has an adjunctive effect in anxiety and depression and bipolar.
Would you give somebody with bipolar, would you add to their supplement regimen some methylated B vitamins or
possibly, but you know, here's the rub is that for some patients, methylated B vitamins just send them over the edge. It just hyper excites them. And this is actually from the experience of some of the autism doctors, is that based on sort of a simplistic analysis of their MTHFR mutations, they'll say, oh, you know, you have an MTHFR mutation, you're not utilizing B12, folate, B6, let's give you high doses of B vitamins. Some of these kids go, whew, they go wild. They tantrum and they bang their heads and they just go nutso with high-dose B vitamins. And the reason is they have another gene mutation called a COMT gene mutation. Mm-hmm. This gets a little complicated, but even as complicated as it seems, we're just scratching the surface of all these interactions. So it's, you know, to use a cookie cutter approach and give patients with mental disorders always methylated B vitamins, it often helps, but sometimes it can backfire. And, you know, one way to tell is to get a genetic analysis. Another way is just to, you know, try it, see how you feel. You feel better? Great. You know,
there you go. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, Cheryl, thank you very much for your question, and best of luck to your husband.
Yep. All right. So this is a good point at which to break, because we generally divide these podcasts into two parts. Listeners are accustomed to that fact. And so what we will do is we'll pause, and then we will resume if listeners follow us to part two. And what can we expect in part two?
Is a diuretic necessary to lower blood pressure?
Okay. We'll tackle that in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thank you. Layla Mutin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist, and we'll be right back with more of Intelligent Medicine.